The following program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Anyone could light a candle. Just like a flower in the wind. You are unique, the same. Each step you take, each dream you realize will open your heart, your life.
Welcome to Our Sacred Journey with your host, Audrey Katagawa. Our program is designed to bring you inspiration, new perspectives, and experiences of love, compassion, and kindness in action. Our guests are global citizens who live and manifest their values, principles, and ideals. Come share in their activism and values that are making positive contributions to humanity. Now, here is Audrey Katagawa.
Good Monday afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Audrey Katagawa, your host of Our Sacred Journey. You know, we just love starting off our work week with inspiring guests. And today I have Dr. Denise Legimodaire joining us. Dr. Legimodaire is an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Pembina, Chippewa, and an assistant professor in the School of Education, Educational Leadership, North Dakota State University, Fargo. She received her doctorate in educational leadership in 2006 from the University of North Dakota, Grand Forks. She worked as an elementary instructor and elementary principal in the Turtle Mountain Reservation. She has been involved in education for over 34 years and is a board member of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Committee. She is a published poet, birch bark biter, which is a traditional painstaking technique that uses teeth to shape tree bark into beautiful artistic designs. She's also a researcher, human rights advocate, and proponent of the rights of women. Thank you so much for joining us, Denise, and I often ask my guests to create the sacred space for our program. I understand that you would like to create the sacred space by sharing a prayer, so if you could please proceed.
Oh, bonjour, Audrey and listeners. I say bonjour in that is a sacred being in our tribe, Nana Bonjour. He taught us many lessons. So when I say bonjour, I greet all of you in a sacred manner. It's not the bonjour of the French, even though my last name is French. It is the bonjour of our sacred teacher. So bonjour, wa bishka bene sawana kwa tikwe, shijak do dame. I'd like to give thanks to the Creator for this day, for our words, and pray that our listeners open their hearts and minds to what is being said here today. And thank the grandfathers, Wabanum, Jawanum, Ngabinum, Kiwetunum, the sacred four directions. Give thanks to the Creator and to Mother Earth, Aki, our true mother. So just Chi Minguich for being able to be here today. Minguich.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that very beautiful prayer with us. You know, you are an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Pembina Chippewa, and I want you to really share with us about their spiritual values and traditions.
Our people were brought by our chief, Little Shell III, from the east. We began a long migration from the ocean far in the east, but our chief brought us from, of course we didn't have a Canadian border, but from around the Red Lake area to Pembina, and then from there brought us to the Turtle Mountains. So we are the furthest west of any Ojibwe tribe in the United States. There are some other of our bands up in what is now called Canada that are also further west. But our people, we, you know, as we'll talk about today, we are a wards of the government. We are colonized people. We were colonized by the French fur traders. They intermarried with us through the years with the Ojibwe and Cree grandmothers. So we became mostly Catholic right now. What has happened in the past, well, maybe 30 years, is what we say something sacred began moving about our reservation. And people began bringing back our Thirsty Dance, what could also be known as the Sun Dance. We brought back the Sweat Lodge ceremonies, the Shake Tent ceremonies, and the Madewiwin. We did have people who still were practitioners of Made on a reservation. So many people have moved into back into what we say the creator, the spirituality that the creator gave us here upon this Turtle Island. And so some of those ceremonies are still very strong. Some will do both. They'll practice both the native indigenous spirituality and Christianity. And then more and more of us are moving into just practicing only our indigenous tribal spirituality there on the reservation. You know, we weren't allowed to practice our spirituality at all until 1978. It was against the law. We had to move our ceremonies underground. We went way out in the bush. We're a heavily forested area in northern, north central North Dakota. And we had to hide our spirituality, and our ceremonies went underground until 1978. And then an act called the American Indian Freedom of Religious Act was implemented. So we could once again practice our ceremonies and our spirituality. We don't have an organized religion, so we just call it a spirituality. So it's only been recently that we've been able to openly practice our spirituality.
So there seems to be a renaissance then undergoing, ongoing, of being able to return to your sacred practices as well as traditions. And what were some of the spiritual values that you're seeing in the resurgence ever since 1978, and as well as were held traditionally before Catholicism?
Well, like I mentioned, the ceremonies, the Sundance and the Sweat Lodge and something called the Shake Tent and Made ceremonies. There's a lot that I'm not allowed to talk about that
I see
that I can't share. Mm-hmm. But some of the neat things that happened with that I'm able to share, that I'm a dancer. I dance powwow dancer and competition dancing and traditional ceremonies, dance ceremonies also, or powwows. And in order to, there's a lot of protocol involved with that. In order to be able to wear a plume, the women need to go and get their traditional tribal name, or it's called our spirit name. It's what we say when we pass on and we travel that Milky Way to cross over to the other side, heaven, if you want to say that, that we call out our name, say, to Makwa or to the bear that's there. He's sort of like a Saint Peter of the indigenous people. And we call out our spiritual name. So a lot of our young people, when we started bringing the powwows and this dance back, they would go to the spiritual leaders or the medicine men in our tribe and ask for their spirit name. And in order to do that, you need to have your parents involved, to have the giveaway, to prepare this food in a sacred manner. So all of those traditions and protocols started being taught again. And then, of course, in order to have a dance, our ceremony must have singers and drummers. So many of the elders started pulling in the younger people to learn these sacred songs that have been passed down for tens of thousands of years. So that is the renaissance, though I like the word that you use, that happened on the reservation. And I'm so glad I got to be part of seeing that and to be part of it.
And so what about the language?
Oh, yes, the language. Well, that's one of the main discussions that we will have here, is about the boarding schools. You know, my parents went to boarding schools, and the first thing they did was literally beat the language out of them, or stick pins in their tongues and threw them in closets and so on to get them to stop speaking the language. So there is a resurgence again of a language that we speak. Two different languages there. One is a mixture of French and Cree. beautiful, beautiful language. It's still very strong and the elders on our tribe and in Canada, and it's called Michif. It's the Métis language, and that's what I actually grew up hearing. My grandmother would speak Michif or Pure Cree to my mom, and my mom would speak English back because mom was boarding schooled where my grandmother wasn't. My father had it completely beaten out of him. So we are teaching it at the community college, and we're teaching both the Métis and the Ojibwe language, or Chippewa, Anishinaabe Moda, it's one of our languages of our tribe too. So that is the language of our ceremonies is the Ojibwe. There's different names for ourselves. If you hear me say Chippewa, Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, they're the same language for the same tribe.
I see. Well, you know, you're mentioning the 1978 American, Freedom of Religion Act. And also, I understand that on March 3rd, 1819, the U.S. Congress passed a Mandatory Education Act. So can you share with us about that act and what impact it had upon the indigenous peoples?
Yes, as one lawyer in the East Coast said at that time, we must either butcher them or civilize them. So it was an act to civilize us, provide against the further decline and the final extinction of our people. It was a movement of the government away from the policy of the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And they decided to appropriate some money to something known as the Civilization Fund. So the way to deal with this so-called Indian problem was to educate us. And at this, and it was a total assimilationist viewpoint at that time, of course, and it was run by churches and missionary societies at that time. That was in the 1819. Continuing on, it still, things were not going well for Native people, of course. The only alternative was, extermination or civilization. But there was a lot of corruption in dealing with this so-called Indian problem. There was something in the late 1850s, early 1860s called Grant's Peace Policy, and that was from the President Grant's administration. And this was a Protestant crusade, which passed legislation again when in trying to deal with the Indian problem. The big thing there was that they said the wars, every time the troops engaged in a warfare with Plains Indians, it cost approximately $2 million a year. So they were looking at cheaper ways. They couldn't kill us off. They were moving into, the government of the United States, which it wouldn't look good to have killed off all of their indigenous people for the democracy. So they were looking at a cheaper way of dealing with the Indian problem was with education. But at this time, it was almost completely in the hands of old Quakers, Episcopalians, Catholics, and religious societies.
I see. And, there was also, I understand, Lieutenant Richard Henry Pratt, whose name is well known among the American indigenous peoples. And I wanted you to share with us, if you could, who he is and why his name is so significant to your people.
Pratt began an experiment in the late 19th century with Arapaho, Cheyenne, Comanche, and Kiowa prisoners who were incarcerated at Fort Marion in Florida. And he decided to do an experiment to see if they could learn. We were considered animals at this time, but he thought he would try to see if these men would be able to learn. And he started teaching them how to read. And then he got them to work throughout the communities and develop trust within the community there about these wild Indians. It's a long history that maybe we can...
Okay, yes, yeah, actually you're right. We're going to have to go to a break, and I'd like you to continue with this history so we can all learn more from what you have to share with us. Don't go away. You're listening to Dr. Denise Legimodier. We're going on break right now.
Thank you. Have you friended us on Facebook yet? Why not? Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for the keywords World Talk Radio. Once you're a part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the World Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our timeline. Just go to facebook.com/World Talk Radio or search for World Talk Radio.
If you think you've seen online TV before, let us surprise you.
VoiceAmerica.tv is online now.
The leader in live internet talk radio has done it again. Multiple channels, a state-of-the-art viewing experience, live and on-demand programs streaming 24 hours a day. It's exactly what you want, when you want it.
VoiceAmerica.tv.
From health and wellness to business, sports, and everything in between. Discover our new world. Visit VoiceAmerica.tv now and experience the future of online television.
VoiceAmerica.tv.
Health is in your hands. What you do and what you don't do sets the course for the path of your life. Listen for Wise Chats, Simple Talk, Profound Wisdom with Dr. Mary Jo Bulbrook. Through this series, we'll explore energetic approaches to health and healing that provide practical and personal solutions. Our guests will share ideas and insights that will help us all adopt new behaviors and create lasting internal shifts. Wise Chats can be heard every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America 7th Wave Channel.
What's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host? For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
You are tuned in to Our Sacred Journey. To reach Audrey Katagawa, please send an email to dmaudrey@lightofawareness.org. That's dmaudrey@lightofawareness.org. And now, back to Our Sacred Journey.
Welcome back to all of our listeners. We have Dr. Denise Legimodier on the line with us today, and we really appreciate what she has to share about the history. And please continue about Lieutenant Richard Henry Pratt.
Yes, he came out of the Civil War, and he was working with these incarcerated Native men in Florida. He was a staunch assimilationist again. He moved away from the policy that, or the slogan that the only good Indian was a dead Indian, and his slogan that is known throughout Indian country is he believed that everything that is Indian in the race should be dead, and he said, "Kill the Indian in him and save the man." So he eventually started a boarding school in Carlisle, and Pennsylvania. And he went and recruited Native people from the Plains area. Now, he was a military man, so his school was completely based upon military values as far as bells and bugles and whistles, and the same thing with the very severe corporal punishment. And we worked. Native, the students would work half a day or a whole day, and then they would learn their reading, writing, and arithmetic the other half of the day. Or very, very little time was actually spent on academics. What happened is that he did some willful over-enrollment in his schools, and the schools were nowhere physically able to accommodate the amount of students that he attempted to enroll, and or that he did enroll, that he brought to Carlisle. And the buildings were not adequate, and students were cold, and there was no protection from the weather and from the elements, and there's just so much that's involved with this. It was just, it was tragic. A lot of the students died of, they were malnourished, and they were hungry, they were cold, they were ill, there was suicide, there were runaways. And this continued throughout the boarding school policy well into even the 1970s. His policy began. His first school was in 1879. The second school was on the other end in the West Coast, and that was Chimawa, and that's where my father was sent. But his belief was, again, kill the Indian, save the man. So he actually liked Indians, but he hated the culture, the language. So the first thing he did was stop the students from speaking their language. He cut their hair the minute they walked through those doors, which was a sign of mourning for many students. He took their clothes away, the tribal clothes, and then he gave them English names. And all of this ended up, of course, affecting them deeply emotionally. And what I've done research, and I've interviewed what I call boarding school survivors recently, and I have my study that's done, that so much of what happened back then was still happening in the 1920s and 30s and all the way up through the 60s with the children. They said that the policy of Pratt schools was to berate, beat, and belittle them. And of course, there was forced assimilation and a cultural genocide, and there was also forced Christianity. There was no chance of the students not being not becoming Christian. They were forced into church. Otherwise, food was kept from them. Beatings, locked in closets and thrown in dungeons at Fort Totten, just a little ways from here where my father also was sent. So it's a terrible time in our history, and that we are still affected by the policies of the boarding school. He also utilized what was called an outing program, to where he sent students out in the community to work for white farmers or work in white homes. And they also were often kept outside the home or put in a barn to stay and in filthy conditions. And I understanding that there was filthy conditions even at Carlisle that the students had to work in. They had to do all of the work of cooking and the cleaning and the laundry. So it was very clean where the students were. But where they had to work was another story. So they were in this outing program, and they were also beaten and sexually molested and raped at this time. And this went on up through, again, the 1970s. So that was his policy, was absolute total assimilation. And there was 25 off-reservation boarding schools at that time. And they all had the same policy. I know my father, when I interviewed him, it was the same thing with the marching. Everywhere they went, they had little wooden guns. And as the boys got older, they had regular metal guns. And they marched everywhere they went. And they also had little jails, mostly that were outside in the elements that students had to, that were put into also when any type of misbehavior. My father said they couldn't even move their eyes side to side when they were in line marching, or they got pulled out and were beaten with straps that had metal studs in them.
So while they were in these boarding schools, were they not allowed to be in communication with their families?
No, they weren't. What's sad is oftentimes the only communication they had is when they were told that their child had died at the boarding school, or when they sent their child home very sick to die. The people I interviewed that went to boarding schools in the 30s and 40s said that they were allowed to call home, but that the nun would stand over them with a stick. And this one lady said her and her sister would be standing there with tears just streaming down their faces with the nun over them with this big wooden stick. And they'd have to say that everything was fine, that they were fine, and they were having a good time, and they were being treated well. And they were standing there just weeping and very frightened of the nun. So that's others were letters, but the letters were redacted. Anything that was not to the liking of the superintendent or the headmaster or headmistress or the nuns was blacked out. And the same thing with any letters that were coming in. They either weren't given to them or they were redacted severely so that the students only heard what the school wanted them to hear.
Well, I know you did a lot of research about the history of your parents and their experiences in the boarding school, and you actually came across some history of your father. So can you please share with us what your research revealed about your dad?
Yes, he had talked about Chimawa, and we actually lived in Portland, Oregon. We were on a program called Relocation in the late 1950s, and Chimawa, Salem, Oregon, is about 100 miles maybe south of Portland, and or maybe it's 50 miles, I can't remember right now. But and he would mention that he went to school there, but it wasn't until I watched a video in the white man's name and then brought him to see it that I really actually sat down and interviewed him about his years at Chimawa. And he had been kept away from school by his adoptive parents. His mom died in the 1918 flu epidemic, and he and grandpa gave him and his sister to two different people to raise. So he was raised by, from the time he was two until he was nine, by an older Cree family and spoke only Cree. And they hid him. They would tell him, "Pimpasta, you know, run, grandchild." And he'd go run and hide in the bush when the Indian agent came around. He was found or caught or turned in by my grandfather in 1925 and sent 3 days and three nights from Turtle Mountain to Oregon on a train with his sister and six others not understanding a word of English. He said it took him a year to learn how to speak Cree. I just couldn't learn that language, he said. That's when he talked about having to march everywhere and the bells and the whistles dictated his entire life. He was also almost killed there with something called the gauntlet. That was a very popular type of discipline instigated by Pratt. Pratt also had older students kind of rat on the younger ones to tell on them or to be involved in helping discipline them. So an older student, he had told another student that he thought a headmistress and a headmaster had a case for each other, had a crush on each other. He was told on, and he was made to lay over his bed with his arms and his legs held by students, and while the students lined up behind him with a belt that had studs in it, and each student had to hit him as hard as they could. If the student eased up on hitting him, then he would have to take his place. Well, he was maybe 9 or 10 years old, passed out, and he was in the infirmary for 2 weeks, and that happened often. He saw a boy from Browning get killed that way. His kidneys were ruptured. So this is not my father's story. It's the story of thousands and thousands of Indian kids that were in boarding schools across the United States undergoing the same type of corporal punishment as he did. He just never recovered from that. He still had the physical scars. He was just in terrible pain. And what's horrifying about that is, of course, there were no one overseeing that, the government officials. There's no one to say, you shouldn't do that, or you shouldn't be hitting these kids like that or disciplining them like that.
Well, actually, it sounds as if it was accepted disciplinary practice. Yeah. And, yeah, so, it's very, very sad. And, I understand that your father really had a difficult time once he got out of the boarding school as an adult as well. So when, I really would like to be able to have you help us understand the impact that this had not only upon your father, but upon your entire family. And we will have to go to another break very soon, but I understand that your father... you helped your father by showing him a documentary for him to watch, which you briefly mentioned earlier, called "The White Man in the White Man's Image." So I really would like you to share with us about that very moving experience that you had with your dad when we come back from break. So you're listening to Dr. Denise Legimodaire. We'll be right back.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN.
Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's Voice America TRN.
Hi, I'm Ed Krell, CEO of Destination Maternity. We proudly support the March of Dimes work to reduce the rate of premature birth. The numbers have gone down in the past 5 years, but still, nearly 500,000 babies are born too soon in the United States each year. We're helping the March of Dimes fund cutting-edge research and community programs to help more moms have full-term pregnancies and healthy babies. Join us in working together for stronger, healthier babies. Visit marchofdimes.com.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
You are tuned in to Our Sacred Journey. To reach Audrey Katagawa, please send an email to dmaudrey@lightofawareness.org. That's dmaudrey@lightofawareness.org. And now, back to Our Sacred Journey.
Welcome back to Our Sacred Journey. You're listening to Dr. Denise Legimaudere. So, Denise, please proceed and share with us about this very powerful experience you had with your father when you brought a documentary for him to watch called In the White Man's Image.
Yes, I brought the DVD. This is in 1976, a year before he died. I brought it home and just sat him down and said, I'm going to watch this. It's about sort of the things that you've been talking to me about. And the documentary went into like everything I've just talked about, the reason for the assimilation policy, the reason, history about Pratt. And they mentioned Carlisle in 1979 and then Chemawa in 1980, which is where Papa was sent. So it went into the corporal punishment and the hunger, the runaways. I noticed in Chemawa, runaways were called deserters. Again, it's military type of terms. The forced Christianity. My father was learned how to be a carpenter from the time he was 10 years old when he was there. The type of vocational. He also learned blacksmithing and tinsmithing. Of course, when he went back to the reservation, there wasn't those type of jobs anymore. So that's what the film went into. The overcrowdedness, the sexual abuse, the guardhouses, the suicide. And one thing we didn't mention either was that they were malnourished, and there was also horrible diseases that swept through all the boarding schools, TB, terrible trachoma, and flus, and even mentioned in one document was smallpox that went through these. So the film talked about all of those issues and why it was, you know, his policy of kill the Indian, save the man. So after the film ended, he just sat there with his head in his hands in his chair, kind of leaned forward, and then he said, so that's what hell they, why they did this to us. And it hit me very powerful, just like a punch in the stomach, that he had no idea that as a Native American, as an indigenous person in the United States, or why he was plucked from this beautiful, loving home on this beautiful reservation and sent 3 days and three nights to a boarding school. And beaten, and haircut, and his language beaten out of him, and in this military-style school that he had no idea until he was 76 years old. And it was a pretty emotional moment for both of us.
I can imagine that it was a very, very powerful moment. And I understand that during your research, you also learned some terms that helped you to understand the impact of your parents' history on your own life. And you learned about, for example, historical trauma, generational trauma, collective trauma, multi-generational trauma, and unresolved grieving. So can you please share with us what these terms mean and how learning of them helped you to understand what you experienced as a child growing up in your family?
Yeah, the historical trauma, I believe the research originally comes out of research of the Jewish Holocaust survivors. And it is collective complex trauma inflicted on a group of people, such as Native people, and the numerous traumatic events a community experiences over generations. And one best way I can explain historical trauma is a recent event that I went to several weeks ago here in North Dakota to a site that's called the White Stone Battlefield. It was actually a horrifying massacre of Lakota people just south here in Fargo, in southern North Dakota. One of the General Sibley or Sully, he was just looking for revenge again for what had happened in 1863 over in Minnesota. And he found a peaceful village of Sioux people, and he slaughtered them. The men were off getting supplies for the winter, so it was women and children. And women even strapped their babies to the dogs and tried to get the dogs out of the village and so on. And the cry was, shoot anything that is wearing a blanket. So I went down there for the memorial of this horrible event. And there were Native people there whose grandmothers or great-grandmothers were there, were children there that hid in the waters or had reeds to try to breathe in the lake. So this historical trauma, it was not that long ago. Wounded Knee was not that long ago. 1863 was not that long ago. I remember my great-grandmother, I remember her well. She was 98 when she passed away and didn't speak a word of English, so Grandma and Mom would interpret for me. So we're still remembering these events, and we're still grieving. And that grieving, that unresolved grieving, is what I think affected my father. I think he was in PTSD from his boarding school era and also, of course, from the war. He fought in the Aleutians against the Japanese. And that grieving, what my research has shown is that, like my father and many others, they never talked about their boarding school era. Excuse me. They never talked about what happened to them in boarding school, mostly because many of them, almost majority, especially the women, were sexually abused. So there's this silence out in Indian country. When I tried to get my work published in indigenous journals, they said, well, you're preaching to the choir. Well, I take issue with that. When I was at a national Native American conference several years back, and there was a poet in there that's written 12 books of poetry. I think he's even a Pulitzer Prize winner. He stood up after my presentation and he said, you know, I've written this many books and I'm a prize winner and award. I have never written one word about my boarding school experiences. So there's still an incredible silence out there. And I think that's our unresolved grieving. It's also called a soul wound. And that's what I said when Papa just shook his head and said, that's what the hell they were doing to us. That's his soul wound that he lived with all his life and did not know it. He didn't have the words for it. Intergenerational trauma, generational trauma. What I've learned from working with the Truth and Reconciliation people up in Canada is that I am what's called a generational. My parents would not ever think of sending us off to boarding school or being separated from us kids. Because of what their experience, what they went through. And yet I learned through my research, and I'm in my 60s and just now understanding this, that Papa and Mom could not ever tell us kids they loved us or hug us, because where did they learn those type of parenting skills? they didn't. They went to boarding schools where they were beaten, and they were locked up, and they were slapped, and they were berated and belittled for who they were. They were never hugged. They were never loved. So I'm trying to break that intergenerational cycle with my grandchildren. I struggle with my children, and even though I've had a lot of therapy to try to deal with all this, but now I've broken that with my grandchildren in hugging them and telling them I love them. Once I was able to understand what happened to me as a child of boarding school survivors and what we now know being termed generationals.
So you said you're still struggling with your own children. Have you shared your research and findings with them and had conversations about your parents' history?
Yeah, with my son, I'm estranged from my daughter at the moment. So, but I've been telling my grandkids are all teenagers right now. So I share all of my research, my writings, and everything with them right now. So hopefully they'll be able to talk to their mom. Right now, it's pretty sad.
Well, I give you a lot of credit for your courage in being able to break the silence and share your own history with your children, your son especially, and your grandchildren. So, you know, my very good wishes to you and your family and all the families of the Indigenous peoples who suffered so much from all of the trauma of the boarding school experience. And can you please share with us about the National Boarding School Healing Project that you're involved with and what its goals and activities are?
Okay, right now I'm president of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, and that came out of the Boarding School Healing Project that was helped started by Andrea Smith. And we organized in 2012, and we have bylaws and board of directors, and we're under the Navajo Nation. And it was a group of people across the United States that we were pulled together by the Native American Rights Fund people and about just what can we do about this, what we need to bring this to national attention. So our vision is to ensure a meaningful and appropriate response for Native American people and communities that were victimized by this boarding school policy. We are identifying goals and a strategy to secure a meaningful response from the U.S. government, and that could include apology. We have a lot of pros and cons about that, but we want to know what does an apology look like. Well, we think that survivors of boarding schools should be the one that would formulate what an apology would look like. We want to secure adequate resources to support healing in communities impacted by the policy. I would like to see whatever healing would look like in any Native community. For my community, maybe it's a Christian ceremony. For another, maybe it's a sweat lodge ceremonies or talking to medicine men. Whatever healing looks like will come from each of the communities, but we need monies to flow from government into these communities to start working on healing this intergenerational trauma and this historical trauma and all of the effects of the boarding school.
Yes, well, you know, I really would like you to go into some of the kinds of activities that you think could really benefit from some funding when we come back from our break. So you're listening to Dr. Denise Legimaudière on Our Sacred Journey. We'll be right back.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog, Press Pass? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective. Plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite host. It's just a click away at VAPressPass.com. That's VAPressPass.com. VA Press Pass by Voice America. All access, all the time.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are tuned in to Our Sacred Journey. To reach Audrey Katagawa, please send an email to dmaudrey@lightofawareness.org. That's dmaudrey@lightofawareness.org. And now, back to Our Sacred Journey.
Welcome back to Our Sacred Journey with Dr. Denise Legimodier. So, Denise, please continue sharing with us about the healing project.
We are also wanting to identify any social, psychological, health, and language and cultural areas that would benefit, of course, by funding. Just trying to bring back the traditions that were lost, forced to lose, and the language and the cultures in these communities. We'd like to see churches accept responsibility for their roles. And what we're mostly doing right now is we're going throughout the United States to national organizations, Native organizations, and asking for the adoption of resolutions. And what we want to do is create a congressional inquiry on the physical, sexual, and cultural abuse, the United Nations human rights abuses that happened at the residential schools. And that's our main goal right now of what we're working towards.
And how do you feel the receptivity factor will be on the congressional level?
Well, we're told right now that not to move it forward to the Obama administration right now, and I'm not real clear about that. We'll discuss that more at our next board meeting.
Okay.
So we're waiting, but we will move it forward.
And I understand that there has been important steps undertaken with the Indigenous peoples and the United Nations and the international legal instruments that have been created, and a lot of progress has been made there.
Yes, I was able to testify at the United Nations, one of the forums just recently that was held in Columbia University in New York. So, and I also testified with Thomas Anaya, when he came, went through the United States, and he was in Rose, but he has the 1,000 pages of single space type documents of my interviews of 20 boarding school survivors. So he has that in his hands.
Well, thank you for doing so much work to be able to collect your research and actually put it in writing and putting it into the hands that could make a difference. I also wanted you to share with us about the White Bison's Wellbriety Journey of Forgiveness. What is that?
Yes, he went on a journey across the United States from Chamawa. He started at Chamawa, and he went across the United States to various boarding schools collecting survivor stories and then doing a healing ceremony. You know, we have to, you know, there's truth and reconciliation, but we have to tell the truth. We have to tell our stories first, and then we have to have healing before there's reconciliation. So we are in the process right now of just truth-telling and then healing. So he has a beautiful ceremony with a hoop that has 100 eagle feathers on it, and a drum and singing. And after people give their testimony, he has social workers and psychologists ready right there for people if they break down and they have that support there that they need for when they give their testimonies. And then he has a ceremony with the hoop. And that's when he had me, he asked me at one point to carry that hoop out at the end of the afternoon. And that's when I knew he talks about forgiving the unforgivable. I had to personally forgive my father for the beatings he put us through. You know, he became an alcoholic, a very violent alcoholic. And it was pretty rough growing up, but no sexual abuse. My father was probably molested at Fort Totten Boarding School. He never talked about it, but But he was verbally and physically abusive to my brother, my sister, and my mom and I. So, it was an extraordinarily moving experience when I carried that hoop out. And I knew it was time to let go of any of the hate or the anger or the... I had to forgive him. And that's what he went across the country doing at different boarding schools all the way across the country. It was an extraordinary movement. And he has hundreds of documented boarding school survivor stories also about the horrors and the human rights violations that happened to Indigenous people across the United States.
So that was a very healing moment for you and for many people as he traveled throughout the United States, the journey of forgiveness.
Yes.
And thank you so much for sharing that. And I know you have been a real advocate for women as well. And share with us about how historically the women of the Indigenous peoples have been treated.
Yeah, I have another essay. I have an essay called My Healing Journey that talks about my boarding school. And then there's another essay I just was recently published about. It's titled something like, you know, we're called through history whores, princesses, and drudges, and prostitutes. But in reality, within our own culture, we were leaders, we were chiefs, we were healers, and we were medicine women. And that's what I want to get out there for young people. And my dissertation, I interviewed 20 extraordinary women leaders in the modern day that were the first time ever leaders of their tribe. It was using a male-dominated position to be tribal chairperson. First time ever president of Haskell Indian Nations was a female. And I asked them at the very end of the interview what advice that they would give to aspiring young Indigenous female leaders. And I also have had that work published also, and do workshops with young girls to just feel good about who they are as Native women and leaders. There's something else called critical Indigenous feminist theory, which I love. It's not the same feminist movement as I was involved in very briefly back in the 70s. You know, Indigenous feminist to us is as leaders, as storytellers, as keepers of our history, our culture, as teachers of the language. That's what feminism means to us as Indigenous females.
Well, thank you. And may they be restored in all ways to their rightful places of power. And what final messages do you have for our listeners?
There's, where do we go from here? I want the listeners to keep boarding school experiences in mind when you work with Native people. Look at what is happening in your schools. Do your students know about boarding schools? Is it in the textbooks? Look at the own gaps in your own education and just educate yourselves about Native people, especially the boarding school era. And if you're a teacher, just start teaching American Indian intellectual history.
Well, you are doing just that in the role that you have as a professor at your university, and I'm sure your influence is far and wide. That coupled with the powerful writings of your poetry, your essays, and your research. So many generations will benefit from all that you have done and are doing to bring us the information that we really have been ignorant about for all these years. And this powerful information is, thank you so much for sharing with us and being able to put in the time to bring through your powerful research to bring it to our ears. So I really wish to express my deepest appreciation to you for taking the time to share your moving and very compelling family history that's been shared by the multitude of families families of indigenous peoples who really suffered greatly in attempts to assimilate them into a system, culture, and way of life so completely foreign to their own. And the trauma which they suffered is slowly being revealed and told. And may these stories help all of us to gain insight and awareness of man's inhumanity to man that speak of serious human rights violations and the degradation of the human being in a systematized way. May God bless you in the good works that you do to help raise the profile of this horrific and tragic history and the ways in which you and many others are helping to bring healing and the preservation of the traditions, culture, and wisdom of the indigenous peoples. Join us again next week for more inspirational conversation. This is Audrey Kitagawa, your host of Our Sacred Journey. My very special guest, Dr. Denise Legimodaire, and I bid you all a very good evening.
Thank you for being a part of Our Sacred Journey. Please join Audrey Kitagawa again next Monday at noon Hawaiian Standard Time, 3 p.m. in the West, 6 p.m. in the East, on the Voice America 7th Wave channel. This week, think about the contributions of love and compassion that you'll make, and how together we can create a better, harmonious, and more peaceful world.
Just like a flower in the wind, you are unique.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.